There was an opening for a political solution that seemed to have taken place, but Saudi Arabia could not keep its end of the bargain. After not opening Sana'a International Airport, based on the ceasefire agreement, it was allowed to have one flight a week, but then it reneged on that also. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this may spell the end of the Yemeni truce and what chances there are for this truce to take shape in order to move into the political process. Well, let's find out more about what has occurred. Abdul Latif Shali is our correspondent who joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So what is the explanation that's been given at this point for this one flight a week, even for that to not happen?
Thank you so much. The Yemenis, since the beginning of this UN brokered truce, they have been knowing that the Saudi coalition will not commit or obey to the terms of the agreement. They said that the Saudi coalition is maybe trying to rearrange its ranks during this period of time, and they are now trying to just keep detaining the Yemeni fuel ships and also obstructing all the flights were supposed to be coming and getting out of Sana'a airport. Today, patients were in the airport in the morning, and they were surprised that the Saudi coalition stopped this flight also, which is only one flight per week, and it's not even enough to help a few hundreds of people during the truce. Now it has passed almost 3 weeks, and the Yemenis did not use the airport. It was supposed to be opened since the first day of the truce, according to the agreement. And unfortunately, Saudi Arabia is only doing everything to undermine the truce. The spokesman of the Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said earlier that the Saudi troops in Marib have conducted a few raids on the city and also have conducted a few military operations against the Yemeni army, but the Yemeni army did not do anything to save the agreement and also to make peace over the country. But unfortunately, the Saudis and all the troops inside the country are trying only to provoke the Yemeni army to launch further operations, whether inside the country or even against Saudi targets. But I believe if they kept just doing this and kept not obeying to the terms of the truce, the Yemeni army will absolutely launch operations, not only here inside the country, but also against maybe Saudi targets, and also Emirati targets will be included in the coming attacks.
Okay, so two key questions before I let you go. First, did they say until further notice? Did they give a date of when the flights would resume? And second key question here, you talked about the reaction by the Yemeni government. They've come out and said they're going to target either UAE or continue with the war. How much time frame did they allow to pass before they started their military operations or restart their military operations?
Two fuel ships are still detained by Saudi Arabia. Sana'a Airport is not opened until the moment. 3 weeks have passed until the moment and nothing happened. So the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people. Why would the Yemeni people keep telling the Yemeni government, the National Salvation Government, to keep holding this truce? They will absolutely demand the Yemeni army, what they will demand the National Salvation Government to do something to provoke the Saudis or to stop the Saudis from detaining Yemeni oil vessels or opening Sana'a Airport. You know, the last attack against Aramco in Jeddah, that was what Yemenis believe that was the reason behind this truce. And if the Yemeni army have launched further attacks like that one in Jeddah, maybe also inside Emirati territories, this will push the kingdom and also the UAE to stop their war against the Yemeni people and lift the blockade. So now 3 weeks have passed and the truce is only for 2 months. So I don't know, maybe it will be for another week or 2 weeks until the Yemeni army say that the truce is with no benefit for the Yemeni people, and also that the Saudis and the Emiratis did not obey to the terms of the truce.
Thank you very much for that. That's Abdul Latif Abu Shali, our correspondent there from Sana'a. Okay, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Hamza Karim is a Yemeni writer and activist who joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Brian Terrell, a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa, I believe.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, great. Welcome to you both. Hamza Karim, let me first start with you. What is going on? You have this indefinite postponement for the flights coming out of Sana'a International Airport, which is the first in 7 years. And you have what was supposed to have been a flight to take, not for recreational use, passengers who needed medical care. So now the permit has been refused to be issued, which is a violation of this two-month truce. Why do you think this has happened?
I truly believe that Saudi Arabia, they don't have serious intentions in committing to any peace, agreements or even this truce that was supposed to last for 2 months. We've seen in the past, for the past 7 years, there have been some truces in place, but really Saudi Arabia wasn't serious about them. Now, what Saudi Arabia is saying is that the main reason that they haven't issued the permit is because, they're asking that all the passports for the passengers should be issued from Aden, which is controlled by them. And then the second issue I think that they're having is that most of the passengers that want to leave Yemen are, the war-wounded survivors. So, these are only excuses used by Saudi Arabia to continue blockading Yemen and increasing the suffering of Yemeni people. The truce for the past 3 weeks, we've seen, military actions have been are still taking places in various provinces like Marib, Hajja, and Saada. There have been over 100 violations since yesterday. The port, the Al-Hudaydah port, is not fully unblockaded. We have two oil ships that are still held by Saudis at Al-Hudaydah airport or Jazan port. They're held there, and they have over 10,000 tons of oil and gas that is really needed by Yemeni people to resume and live a normal life, needed by hospitals, needed by the cars, needed for transportation, needed by factories. So far, what we've seen is that Saudi Arabia really are not committed to the truce, or are not willing to go further to resume peace talks.
Brian Terrell, something's not making sense here. When you take a look at when the truce was announced, and it's not a truce that is the first time that was announced. We've had truce announcements before, and this was followed by certain political steps also that we're going to get into in a bit. But we're having on multiple occasions Saudi led coalition to have broken the truce. The airport, one instance, then you have the, what we understand, positions in Marib of the Yemeni armed forces to have been targeted. You have oil tankers that are being impounded. And it was announced on April the 2nd, and here we are. It's just a little over 3 weeks old. Why do you think Saudi Arabia is committing these violations?
Yeah, it's 3 weeks into this, and we've said it over and over again for so many years that this is a human catastrophe. This is an emergency, and it ought to be dealt with as an emergency. And the food, the situation now in Yemen with, exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, which provides 40% of Yemeni wheat. And now the food prices, just since this war started, has gone up 150% in Yemen, where most people can't afford the food and couldn't afford the food to begin with. So no, there's not goodwill here, and there's not goodwill on the part of the United States either. President Biden as a candidate parroted what everybody else is saying about the disaster of the war in Yemen and how barbaric it is and how it has to stop, and pledged U.S. cooperation with the Saudi effort would end. And in the first year of the Biden presidency, more than $1 billion worth of missiles sold to the Saudis. We're also seeing. I'm really happy to see that there's now a new effort by some people in the U.S. Congress to make a War Powers Resolution Act to stop the United States from cooperating with the Saudis. And this is something that the Democrats have done before. When Trump was president, and knowing that Trump would veto such a bill, and he did when it was passed. And now the Democrats largely are not behind this, and I think it's because it will force Biden into a situation where he'd have to either pass or veto such a bill. So yeah, and what's happening at the airport is like the idea that because some of the passengers don't carry passports from the Aden government, which in almost any way you want to look at it, doesn't exist anymore. You know, right after the early this month, the President Hadi was dismissed or stepped down, replaced by a presidential leadership council. It's a government that doesn't really exist, and any kind of negotiations, any real negotiations, with Yemen has to include the government that is actually in power, whether people like it or not. The Nasrallah government is the government of Yemen. And there can't be any resolution without recognizing that and recognizing their passports, being able to talk at high levels with them it's absurd to think that any steps forward can be made without that.
All right. Well, let's since you mentioned the U.S. and at the end there you're talking about that presidential council. Let's talk about the U.S. If we can, Hamza Karim. I'm looking at the statement made very recently by the U.S. President Joe Biden on this, of which he has said that he has welcomed the agreement, but he said the terms of the ceasefire was just the first step. Again, I'm looking to see where this went wrong. Do you think that there was any kind of pushback by the U.S., change of mind by the U.S., then relate to Saudi Arabia? Because we know that the U.S. is trying to, one way or another, whether Joe Biden likes it or not, trying to claw its way back into the Saudis' liking, based on some reports. Do you think maybe the U.S. instigated a change of mind on the part of Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. I think, Saudi Arabia in this war, they haven't been really driving or leading this war. We all know that Saudi Arabia can't make any moves, especially like these big moves, without a green light from the U.S. administration. Now, if we all remember that this truce came after the attack that happened in Aramco in Jeddah, and we all know that back then and even now, U.S. cannot stand seeing the gas prices going up and do nothing about it. The war in Ukraine right now is already driving the prices of gas up, and they can't take seeing the prices going even more. So I think there was some pressure on Saudi Arabia to really at least absorb some of the anger that is happening in the international community and inside Yemen because of this war, really rearrange themselves in Yemen and trying to get all the groups that are fighting for Saudi Arabia and UAE and US together and really get their ducks in a row to go back to this war again. For me, I don't see US really being very serious about stopping this war in Yemen. If they were very serious about it, they would have, stopped selling arms to Saudi Arabia. They would have really just stopped providing them with all the intelligence and the logistics to continue this war. But so far, we haven't seen any serious steps or taking place by the U.S. So definitely, U.S. is not happy and are not willing to really stop this war. We haven't seen any serious actions. So I definitely agree that since the beginning of this truce, Saudi Arabia and U.S. weren't serious. They were just trying to buy some time to get their ducks in a row, to rearrange themselves, and to go back into this war.
Okay, well, let's go through the motions here as to where this stood in terms of the presidential council, or, excuse me, presidential Leadership Council, Brian Terrell. On April 7th, this was sworn in before the parliament in Aden. Okay, and there they announced that they were going to negotiate with the Ansarullah movement for a permanent ceasefire, which then we were looking at the two-month ceasefire that came into, or truce, that was announced. And then we went through that show about Hadi transferring powers to the council. Of course, many are deducting that the Saudi Crown Prince fired him, pretty much. But then we're looking at the representation of power, where there's an equal distribution of power between the countries north and south, and then you have the council, which includes the prominent leader of the SDC, the Southern Transitional Council, supported by Saudi Arabia and also its coalition part of the UAE. I went through this in order to ask you whether there was a change of heart or something that did not now stand well with Saudi Arabia in terms of the composition of the Leadership Council or the way that this went down. What do you think?
No, I really don't know about that. I think what's interesting is the Hadi government was the reason that the justification that Saudi Arabia gave to begin with to be in Yemen at all in the first place. So with that gone, what, you know, it kind of takes the chair out from under the Saudis and their excuse. I think that there is a you know, there is a fear that the Saudis have and the United States has that peace might break out, and if this presidential leadership council shows any promise of really negotiating, with the Houthi government and really coming to an end to this this war and this horrible starvation, that will be stopped. That will not be tolerated by the Saudis or the United States. This is a cash cow, and the rising of the gas prices, as our friend said, is a very big issue here. While the gas prices are going up, the profits for the oil companies are going up too. So the anger needs to be assuaged, but we don't want to start bringing the prices down either. You know, the planet is in really bad shape, and we're in danger of catastrophic climate change. And all this time, all these these months that should be used, the research, the resources that should be put into finding alternatives to fossil fuels, instead are going toward this war. And we're seeing in the United States the Biden administration is not only allowing for more permits to drill and to frack, to use U.S. Oil and gas to counteract what's being boycotted from with the Russians. Right. We're putting everything as being set back, and the world is being put. We need to do something very, very different. Sure. We need to do it quick. The people of Yemen are suffering, and they're dying now. And mass starvation is real. But the whole planet needs the Saudis and the United States and everybody, the Russians, to change its course.
Sure. Well, this Presidential Leadership Council, Hamza Karim, I'm curious as to whether this was going to work anyways. Because if you want to take a look at the way that the leadership was going to be, it was very murky as to what type of influence could the Saudi side have when we know on the ground it is the Ansarullah currently and the Yemeni government who have the support from the people. I mean, who does Saudi Arabia have or can put in place there for any type of reconciliation to happen? That's always been a big question mark.
Yeah, just to give you a bit of background about this Presidential Leadership Council. So what Saudi Arabia did alongside with UAE, and backed by the US, of course, is trying to group all the groups in ground in Yemen that had problems and even fought and killed each other in the past. There are some groups who are aligned with the UAE. Some of them are aligned with Saudi Arabia. So what they tried to do is put all these groups together. Now, these groups, the members of these groups, they all have power in ground except for the president of this of the Presidential Leadership Council. But so what they're trying to do is basically get all these groups together and make them sit down and really work as a team. But we've seen this for the past 7 years. This did not work. These groups, they fought with each other. They killed each other in Aden, in Marib, in Shabwa, in many provinces. And but I think there is some kind of pressure now on them to come together and work under one leadership. But I don't think this is going to work because all these groups have their own agendas. They all have their own plans. They want to they want to control some certain areas in Yemen. And it's very hard to bring them all together under one umbrella and put a one leadership for them all. So in my opinion, I don't see this is working because, you know, they all have different agendas. They all have different objectives. They all have different visions. And it's very hard to put them all together in one table.
Well, then what are we looking at, Brian Terrell, if this thing falls apart, which is unfortunately going in that direction? What type of direction is this thing going to go, which we're looking at the threat that the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni government has made, is that they're going to again go through targeting Saudi Arabia and the UAE?
Yeah, it doesn't look good in this council by the very fact that it was pretty much appointed and put in place by the Saudis means it's going to fail. The Saudis do not hold the key to solving the problems of Yemen, and neither does the United States. I hate to see it. It looks, as our friend says, it seems inevitable that the Saudi military is going to react as militaries do and as governments do, and under the provocations that it's facing. And it's not going to go well for the people of Yemen either. Because the Saudi, the UAE, and the United States and our different allies are definitely stronger than the Yemenis have proven themselves very bravely and very and used a lot of ingenuity with its limited weaponry, but in the end, by sheer firepower, this is not going to be a military solution. It's not going to be a military solution that's imposed by the United States or Saudi Arabia, and it's not going to be a military solution that comes out of the Ansarullah government either. The promise that this showed of a negotiated end to the war is, as it falls apart, is all the more bitter because, in the end, that's the only thing that's going to happen. Someday it's going to happen. And how many people are going to have to die before then? Because there isn't any solution. Nothing will happen unless there's really good faith efforts for all parties to sit down and negotiate an end. And we have not seen any goodwill on the part of the Saudi Arabia or U.S., the UAE, the other coalition partners. It doesn't look good for the near future. We have to. Our hope has to be a little farther out, and our prayers are with the people of Yemen. And as an American, my apologies are just so heartfelt, and I feel so bad about what our government's been doing to the people of Yemen and people all over the world.
All right, we're going to end it there. We are fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist. Hamza Karim, thank you, Yemeni writer and activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion discussing the concept of Al-Quds Day are two important guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Yasser Ibrahim and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
I'm Badr Yasser Ibrahim. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
So, Al Quds Day, the last Friday of the month of Ramadan, which was named, by the late Imam Khomeini, after the Islamic Revolution of Iran took place in Iran, but this concept nowadays can be witnessed all around the world. And it is mostly juxtaposed with a kind of resistance movement, which has started from Palestine against the Zionism, but now it could be called a general topic or general concept against imperialism and colonialism all around the world. And alhamdulillah, it is not limited only to Al Quds Day or the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. This sense of defending the rights of the Palestinians, could be seen on the footage and the coverage of the media, especially from the Muslim lands all around the world during the year, all the days of the year. But the case is that how a Muslim could be neglectful of the rights of another Muslim. I mean, even in the religion of Islam, if then we can say that Mazlum or Mustaz'af is a Christian one or a Jew one, the Islam, has the right in order to defend him, and has beautiful, we got beautiful statements from Prophet Muhammad and the Shia infallible Imams on supporting them. But the case is that nowadays we are living in a world that said the money is everything for the politicians. And these kings, they are called kings, the kings of the Arab lands, they have this aristocrat lifestyle. They are the kings. The kings cannot think about the oppressed ones because they are the king, okay? They are not the truthful muttaqi leader, as you said, Sayyid Mohsen. Now, how to promote this concept during all other days of our life? What should we do? I mean, for example, Quds Day could be limited only to Friday. Demonstrations and the rallies are done around the world, the footage and the coverage, the media coverage, and then done. What about the other activities that we can do during all days of the year in order to keep it alive inside the Muslim Ummah?
Obviously, the first thing that we can do is be updated with the news, what's happening in the world. One of the unfortunate things is that the people are away from the news that is happening in the world. We more get involved in, the comments on the pictures on the Facebook or maybe Instagram and other things. Obviously, yes. Social media has its own role. And maybe spending the whole year, most of the time when we are free, watching movies or like spending time with the friends. Yes. But the main thing is we should know about what's going on in the world, mm-hmm. because the things that are happening to the others can also happen to us.
Okay.
It can happen with us. So we need to be... We need to get the knowledge about the things, about the current affairs.
Yes.
This is very important because a Muslim is a one who knows about everything. And the concept of the Friday even, the Friday prayer, is that the Imam of the Jum'ah or Jama'ah, when he comes,
yes.
there is a sermon which he specifies about the taqwa,
yes.
the God-very, and how to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The second is a political sermon.
Yes.
That he has to talk about what's going on in the place where he's living,
yes.
in the town, and then in the country, and then at
the issues of the Muslim lands. But
and
unfortunately, we do not see that in some of the Friday sermons, of the key holders of Kaaba around the world. They talk about anything, but not this point.
And
I mean,
if you see that even in the narrations, and the one who delivers the lecture, like the sermon, on the Friday,
yes.
he's holding a weapon.
Yeah.
Either a sword or a weapon or anything, or maybe a stick. Why? Because this is the sunnah of the Prophet, that the Friday sermon is the sermon in which we are talking about the issues of the, the oppressed ones and the oppressors and how to save and what to do. So basically,
but that weapon in the hand of that Imam, I think, very much signifies the killing of the young people, and executing them, brother. The case is that I think, the religion for some of the kings of the Muslim lands is very much limited to only Salat and so on, reading out the Quran.
Yes.
But when you got to the socio-political and the cultural scene, and the defense of the rights of the Mazlumin and Mustazafin all around the world, it's absolutely forgotten.
One more thing which we need to basically focus on, and this is important, that when we look at these kings that you're referring, or the crown prince,
yes.
we are you're referring to them, or maybe the president or prime minister of the Muslim countries.
Yes.
Like, you know, we know generally,
yes,
most of them, when you look at them, just look from where they qualified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the political leaders, when you look at their CV, their educational history, just look where they qualify. Either they have qualified from Cambridge or Oxford, or they were in Harvard, or, you know, the universities that are in the West. So they are not going to be patriot. You know, they're not going to think about their own country. They will be serving the policies and the goals of the Western world where they qualified.
Yes.
And they have trained them in a way and then deplotted them. Obviously, these are the issues that we have. You know, if I think that I am backward, you know, that's another issue. That the Muslim Ummah has this thinking which was changed by Imam Khomeini. And he changed this thought in the Islamic Republic of Iran, that we are not backwards. It's the one who does not know from where he came,
yes,
where he's living, where he will go.
Okay.
We know this. And therefore, we see that the Iranian, like, they advanced in the technology, in the you know, the defense.
Yes.
They advanced in the medical sciences. Why is it so? Because this mentality which was injected into the Muslim Ummah that you're backward,
yes,
you're not advanced.
Yes.
So this thinking was changed. But when you go to the Arab countries, when you go to the other Muslim countries, they say, oh man, they are the developed ones. No. We have to follow them. We have to follow
more
their
Catholic
civilization.
Than Pope.
Yeah, civilization, yes, culture. Even yes, in the schools that we have, they prefer to send their kids, like general people,
yes,
in the Muslim countries,
so,
where they have the, you know, the syllabus of the Oxford and Cambridge.
That's
and
right.
When you look at the syllabus of Oxford and Cambridge, the philosophy behind it, it is, you know, pursuing some goals which were set by them to change people towards...
You know, Said Mohsen, in this, you're talking now about the secularism. You know, in this secular capitalist, you know, imperialist world, the people are only thinking about themselves. How to fill their bank account
this is injected
with the money
from somewhere. This,
you know,
this has come from
it. Unfortunately, they are equipped with the oil, with the petrol money. When the petrol money is in their pocket and the policies come from the Western ones, there is no room now for Mustazafin, brother. And the gap is becoming bigger and bigger every day, I think.
So therefore, our responsibility is, you know, it's heavier, it's
yes,
high. We must, you know, perform our responsibility as a person who appears on the social media, or if we have access to that, we need to aware people.
Yes.
Those who are preachers or ulama, they must aware people. You know, these things are happening, and that's why we see that even the protests that we have on the day of Quds, it's getting bigger and bigger in number.
Yes.
It's the people who are participating in it. They are like, you know, the number of people is,
yes,
becoming bigger and bigger. Like, we can see, like, you can see, like, the protest that was happening maybe 10 years
yes,
ago or 15 years ago in London, and now you see how many people are there. We can see, like, the protests that are happening in New York, in other places.
Yes.
You know, on the day of Quds, it means that, you know, even from this side, people are
yes,
doing their job.
Okay.
And it is not just like, you know, if we just look at the, you know, rulers of the Muslim
yes,
country, obviously we have a negative. We will see the negativity only.
And alhamdulillah, there are so many justice seekers, truth yes, seekers from all around the world. You know, for example, this famous doctor, Dr. Trond Ali Lindstad,
mm-hmm,
you know, the Norwegian, you know, a doctor who was given the national trophy, you know, the national trophy of patriotism, but unfortunately he was banned from being given because the Israeli lobbies inside Norway has blocked the whole ceremony and he was not given. He's always present with the in the Palestine helping the injured people and so many other people, you know, who are Christians, who are not even Muslims, but has understood the significance of this land and this humanitarian, you know, I mean, catastrophe that is taking place in Yemen, in Palestine, in Syria, Iraq. But unfortunately, some of the kings not. Okay, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, your final remarks.
One of the issues that we didn't speak about, I'll just quickly mention it, was BDS.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things was, how do we, other than Quds obviously is a show of support, physical support.
Yes.
But BDS of boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions
yes,
is another completely different
yes,
thing that, as you mentioned, can be done throughout the year.
Yes.
It's not just one thing, you know. putting pressure on certain companies, putting pressure or not buying, you know, products of certain companies. Right. You know, there's always this list that goes out and stuff, right? So, for example, you know, as a Muslim, at least, you know, I remember some people would ask, you know, but, you know, so many other people throughout the world buy it and so on. I said, but at the end of the day, that person will not be asked about whether or not that person bought it or not. You will be asked, did you buy it or not? You don't have to worry about whether that person bought it or not. I may not have a great economic impact individually on a particular thing, but it's a start.
Yes.
You know, one person, two people, three people. I mean, right now the BDS movement is under extreme pressure from the Israeli lobbies throughout the world. Why are you doing? Why are you pushing it? People don't actually know. Mm-hmm. Now, many people don't know. There was a group of friends of mine who stood outside one of these companies in the UK, and Muslims would walk in, they would give them a leaflet. Mm-hmm. That this is what this company does.
Oh.
When a Muslim would read it, say, we didn't know this, and they would walk away from that company.
No.
People, like I think Sayyid Mohsin mentioned, the people are not educated, people don't know, people don't want to know sometimes.
Yes.
But when you inform them about something, they will make an educated decision. People are not, you know, just like of fools, or they're not, you know, uneducated. People know, if you just tell them, you know, this is clear, right and wrong, then they'll be able to exceed quite clearly. And, you know, I think education is one, and then two, also the impact of what education can do is something that needs to be more focused on as well.
Inshallah, if the Muslim, we can say, Ummah, is woken up to their duties, you know, and the Islamic scholars especially, you know, because sometimes the ordinary people and the public, they are not guilty. This is the problem from the side of the scholars and the ulama of a society, to get them awakened, to rise against oppression, to feel responsible for the huquq of the mustazafin. And this is, I think, the true Islam, that Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imam through movements were after. They were not after only praying or salat or psalm, you know, or reciting the whole Quran, you know, just reciting and reciting and reciting without practicing what are the contents of the ayahs. And I think all the Islamic schools can act against the same enemies that are around the world in order to guarantee the honor and the independence of the Muslim nations. I think this is really important. And all the Islamic countries must feel responsible in this case, I think. Thank you very much, Brother Yasser Ibrahim and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Inshallah, one day Palestine will be free, Yemen will be free, Syria, and all the countries, you know, who are under the clangs and the oppressions of the oppressors, the zalimeen across the world, will be free, inshallah, one day. We pray for that day. Inshallah, may Allah hasten the reappearance of Imam al-Asr, Imam Mahdi Jalallah, who is really the true herald, the true pioneer, the true man who gonna establish society with the justice and social justice all around the world, inshallah. Thank you very much. For more information and to download for free, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Allah. Imam Khomeini said, "The racist Zionist regime has always been a source of discord among regional states."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Just ahead of International Quds Day, support for Palestinians is gaining momentum across Lebanon. This seminar was held in the Lebanese capital, where the speakers touched upon the significance of the Quds Day.
The significance of this holiday is that Imam Khomeini called on the free people of the world and the Muslims of the world and the Christians of the world to look at this historic, religious, and national enemy which wants to steal your sanctities and Judaize your city and bury your heritage. Be cautious on this threat and be united to face this aggressive enemy.
With the violent Israeli crackdown against the people of the Holy City in Palestine, activists say the sacrifices of the Palestinians will be fruitful, and that Al-Quds Day is an occasion for Muslims to stand united in supporting the Palestinian cause.
Imam Khomeini considered that our Arab and Islamic identity is incomplete without liberating Al-Quds. Therefore, this is a shame for those who continue to normalize ties with this enemy that continues to launch the most heinous assaults with their artillery and bullets. Thousands of wounded people have lost their eyesight, and many of them lost one eye or two. Hundreds of wounded people fell in the past assault. We will eventually pray in Al-Quds, no matter how long it takes.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General also stressed that Al-Quds is not merely a piece of land. It is rather an international humane cause. And Imam Khomeini established a cultural, ethical, and religious system to liberate it.
Mizatul Imam.
Imam Khomeini did not only make a declaration, he put a roadmap for the liberation of Palestine. He did not only call on the people to hold commemorations and events and make speeches to celebrate a day for Al-Quds, he directly closed the Israeli embassy and opened the Palestinian embassy. He founded Al-Quds Brigade as part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which would begin to form the army of 20 million. This would extend to the rest of the region and would support resistance inside Palestine. The only objective is to liberate Palestine.
All the speakers at the conference agreed that those who believe in the Palestinian cause are convinced more than ever that Al-Quds in Palestine will be liberated. International Quds Day has developed from being a day of solidarity and vocal support to being a day of practical coordination between the resistance factions. The Resistance Alliance has for once ratified a unified strategy of defense, and the focal point is Al-Quds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Hundreds of thousands of refugees continue to flow into the European Union from Ukraine. The EU is providing residency permits, access to the labour market, housing, medical assistance, and free education for children for a period of at least 1 year. Now the European Commission has unveiled plans to make these benefits permanent.
This is happening as de facto we're having 5 million Ukrainian refugees in our member states.
The European Commission's new initiative is called the Legal Migration Policy.
Could be used, for example, for employers and member states to find Ukrainian teachers that they need to employ to help for the Ukrainian children.
Critics are incensed as they look back at how the EU closed its borders to refugees fleeing conflicts in the Middle East and Africa that the West helped to create. 26-year-old William Ibrahim now lives in Brussels, having left his native country, Syria. He says the EU has a legal responsibility to treat all refugees the same.
Regardless where is the refugee come from, or what is his race, or his color, his religion, we just be fair to him.
Relations between the EU and Russia over the conflict in Ukraine have gotten even worse. Moscow has cut off gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria for not paying in Russian rubles.
The latest aggressive move from Russia is another very stark reminder that we need to work with reliable partners and build our energy independence.
The Kremlin is scathing of unprecedented sanctions being imposed against Russia by the EU and the West's policy of sending billions of euro worth of deadly weapons to Ukraine. Due to the energy and refugee crises, the EU is facing economic ruin, some experts warn. It means the EU project is under threat like never before, because hard-pressed citizens might turn against the political establishment. It's for this reason that many analysts are saying EU leaders might look back on their handling of the Ukraine-Russia question with enormous regret. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017.
I didn't vote in the second round. In the first round, I voted for third place finisher Jean-Luc Mélenchon and decided to abstain. I think it's better that Macron won instead of Le Pen, who is too extreme right for me.
Macron's problem is that, once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue. A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of this international conference that drew political figures and activists from across the world to Tehran to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israel's occupation.
The message of the conference here is for expressing unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering and who are struggling for their independence and their sovereignty.
The centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Muslim world is what we want to remind some of the Arab states that ignored this fact and contemptibly normalized their ties with the criminal regime of Israel despite the will of their nations. Some Arab leaders must be ashamed even more now when we see that the Israelis are attacking Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound site since early April, with the onset of the holy month of Ramadan, which coincided with Jewish Passover. Last week, more than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured when Israeli forces stormed the compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has pressed ahead with its violence in the Flashpoint site and has been cracking down on solidarity protests throughout the occupied West Bank.
What is happening today in Palestine has been repeated for the last 72 years. Added to that, that today the crimes of Israel has exceeded all the human rights and all war crimes. UNESCO itself has declared that Al-Aqsa Mosque is an Islamic sanctity, is an Islamic place. It has nothing related to the Jewish religion. What is the relevance to the extreme Zionist Jewish settlers to get into the mosque and pray over there? There is no relation to them over there. What we want today is that the international community has to understand that Israel has violated the freedom of worshipping rights.
This conference is held ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Activists here regard Quds Day as an opportunity to shed light on the Israeli crimes in Palestine and hope that it would instigate the international community to take action in support of Palestinians.
Delegates here say Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, calling on Muslims worldwide to participate in the International Quds Day en masse. They say this is the only way to bring the Palestinian cause to light amid attempts by Tel Aviv to sweep its crimes under the rug. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The EU and its Western allies continue to pour hundreds of millions of euro worth of deadly weapons into Ukraine. Speaking in India on Monday, the head of the bloc's executive arm, Ursula von der Leyen, defended this policy.
Our response to Russia's aggression today will decide the future of both the international system and the global economy.
Just last week in the European Parliament, a number of legislators questioned the wisdom of pumping lethal weapons into Ukraine.
If there is a ceasefire, who's going to disarm those individuals who are receiving these arms? We know how weapons sent to fight Al-Assad in Syria ended up being used for attacks in other countries.
Also, it's clear many EU citizens are against the enormous militarization of Ukraine by the West.
If you send weapons, maybe you will encourage the conflict.
We all must hope that all need peace.
I think the peace is the best way.
Weapon is not the answer to nothing.
Poverty is on the rise in the EU, and so campaigners say the huge amounts of money being spent on providing weapons for the conflict could be better spent.
People are faced with the COVID crisis, you know, with energy crisis, you know, the bills of people are tripled or even quadrupled. So it's something ununderstandable.
But the European Commission insists the arming of Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict.
The war can stop today if Russia decides that it should stop. It has nothing to do with the arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine is only defending itself.
However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Otherwise, they suggest, there is no way of ending this conflict. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hundreds of protesters flocked to central London on Sunday to honour the call of International Quds Day. The annual event, held on the last weekend of Ramadan, was initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979 to express solidarity for Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism.
Israeli aggression against Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan has become so regular that it's turned almost regrettably into an annual tradition. That's why tensions are so high this year, as continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is ongoing even at the time of this recording.
Due to its popularity, many attempts have been made by pro-Israel groups to ban the rally, with critics citing anti-Semitism accusations. Event supporters, however, rubbished these claims.
The Al-Quds demonstration
is in support of the Palestinians in their fight against Zionism. Zionism is a totally different philosophy to Judaism. Zionism is a false secular philosophy. Judaism is an age-old religion. Being against Zionism is being against falsehood. Nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all.
The very fact that the protest movement is being criminalised and there are efforts to ban it, I think that speaks volumes. They don't want concepts of resistance to be spoken about. Like, I'm not sure if you realise in some of the protests, there's an emphasis on 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation no more, but not an emphasis on 5, 6, 7, 8, Israel is a terror state, right? It's like we have solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. We call out their victimhood, but we also target the aggressor.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound has been at the centre of weeks of heightened Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers since the beginning of the Holy Month. With at least 19 Palestinians killed so far, fears remain high that another full-scale war could break out as Gaza's resistance threatens greater retaliation. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the Israeli escalation against Palestinians, Yemenis have held a conference called Palestine, the Central Cause of the Nation, in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Senior officials have participated in the event to express their support for Palestinians.
The conference was held in Sana'a, the capital, which represents a symbol of a steadfastness and resistance in the face of those who normalize relations with the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni people are a living example of free people, as the central issue for us is Palestine. If Yemen was still ruled by the previous regime, it would have been portrayed as having normalized relations with Israel. But praise be to God, the Yemeni people have been liberated.
Organizers said this conference is a preparation for the celebration of the International Quds Day, as Yemenis will fill the streets of Sana'a to prove their solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
This conference comes as part of preparations for marking Quds Day, which will be unprecedented this year, as the Yemeni people will come out to confirm that Palestine is the central issue of the nation. The message that we are sending through this conference is that the Yemeni people, with all their sects and components, insist that the Palestinian cause is the basis for the solution to all the problems facing the Islamic nation.
During the conference, the president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, called for forming official and popular funds to support the Palestinian people and returning the Palestinian issue to the curricula to emphasize its importance for all generations.
Despite everything that is currently happening in the world and the catastrophic situation in the country, people who say they will never forget the Palestinian cause, they say it is the time for the free people of the world to prove their support for Palestinians against ongoing Israeli crimes.
Israel, since its creation, has always touted itself as invincible, especially because of possessing advanced weapons and receiving unwavering military, intelligence, and financial support from the West, in particular the United States. Nonetheless, the myth of Israel's invincibility has been shattered over the past years as the regime suffered severe blows in the face of fierce resistance by the Palestinians, both in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Irrespective of the casualties Israeli forces have sustained in the West Bank in response to their crimes against Palestinians, retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities have turned the spotlight on the regime's vulnerability. Since March 22nd this year, Palestinians have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations in Israel, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Such retaliatory operations reflect the fact that Israel will have to brace itself for an armed resistance inside its cities. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, the regime's spying fiasco also made headlines after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's much-vaunted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. But such incidents are just the tip of the